Are we talking about rain-fed crops in particular? Some of these concepts might not apply to irrigated crops, and when I refer to stress with no specifics, it will be water stress. Crop yield depends on two factors: the environment where the crop is grown and the actual technology we use to establish, protect, grow, and harvest the crop. The technologies do have a life cycle, which is controlled by political, social, and economic factors. Say GM is an actual technology here in the States, but it's a potential technology in South Australia for political reasons. So it's about environment and technology. Environment and technology interact. This is the most common interaction. High rates of improvement in better environments. David Lobel showed a similar trend for corn in the Midwest. Technology yields higher returns in better environments. And there's an interesting exception. This is the only one I'm aware of, sorghum in Australia, where the interaction is reversed. It's been larger improvement in yield through genetics and agronomy in dry conditions. This is a very particular small community of growers and scientists, and they've been working for decades in improving drought adaptation in sorghum. Stay green hybrids, refined management of raw spacing, that kind of thing. This is quite unique, I think. The relative weight of technology and environment depends on two things. One is the level of aggregation of the output, and the other is the time scale. For a single crop in the short term, the top two graphs, we see this no technological trend and a large environmental-driven variation. The fact that the trends are flat doesn't mean technology is not important and it's not making an effect. If we remove technology there, probably the trend would be negative, in particular because of breakdown in disease tolerance. If the level of aggregation is large, like many industries in a country over long term, that's the bottom graphs, you see the very strong indication of technological improvement. But yet, production is subject to disruptions, environmental or political, like in that case. So the environment is a very important source of variation. In the short term, the environment is much larger than technology, including genetic improvement, with two exceptions. Some traits have a truly high heritability. Seed weight, for example, 70%. So that the ranking between environment and genetics is reversed. The second exception is more interesting. It's my bias. If I screen 200 lines in one or two environments, I will be overestimating G and underestimating E. And I was surprised when I started to collect this data to see 70% of the reports of heritability in a single environment. I would like to know what the meaning of that is. But the other interesting aspect from looking at this data set is a number of reports of yield in single rows or two rows or space plants. And we'll talk about that and what does it mean a bit later. So the environment is very important. And sometimes, not always, but often, what we see is a very superficial description of the environment, like site and season. The crop doesn't have a GPS. The crop doesn't respond to Phoenix or somewhere else. And my point is, we use the most advanced technology for genetics, for biometrics, and so forth, and then we say the environment is location and season. And that is, I think, a constraint to get the full value of those technologies. So I would be talking about the environment in particular, a bit on G by E from the perspective of plasticity, and if I have time, I'll touch on some work we're doing on genetics of crop adaptation. So this is Scott Chapman's concept in the 2000s, first applied to sorghum in Australia. The first step is to run a water balance model. We have a supply-demand ratio on a phenological scale. We multiply a number of locations and seasons, and you have a few thousand of those trajectories. The second step is cluster analysis, where that's reduced to somewhere between 3 and 5, depending on the crop and the region. And that 3 to 5 types of drought would account for 50% or more of the total variation. And the third step is to check that classification of stress patterns makes sense agronomically, and then we can do a number of things. We can map the probability of occurrence of each stress type. We can identify redundant locations, and we can weight results of comparison of varieties or practices. Another thing we can do is to define an environment experimentally. With rainfall shelters and irrigation, we can say we can screen varieties for environment type 3, and the traits and the ranking of varieties will be very specific for that kind of environment. Where we don't have those facilities and we rely on variation due to season and site, we can still model the water supply and demand. This is a study where we are screening field peas, and the supply-demand ratio at that point, 200 degrees after flowering, accounted for 40% of the variation in yield. So my varieties will align to that very specific aspect of the environment. This is the pattern of water stress for wheat in Australia, and for a long time we've been talking of terminal drought, which is a vague concept, and it's misleading because it's forced people to think in adaptation to drought, meaning grain filling, saving water for grain filling, low planting density, low nitrogen rates. But if we look at the stress indicated with the arrow, that's the more important one, because it's very common and because it's the one that causes the largest yield reduction. And that stress, I wouldn't say it's terminal. It starts 400 degrees before flowering, and it would affect grain filling, but the problem is by the time the crop is filling grain, yield collapsed because grain set was compromised. So these are examples of shifting from a qualitative to a quantitative environmental characterization. Now I will open a bit of sidetrack and look at the adaptations of phenotypic adaptations to these environments. We've been doing this kind of experiments where we compare a set of varieties representing 50 years of breeding, and all the work except the most recent one is in the field and in a number of environmental conditions where we change, in particular, nitrogen supply. And this is the summary of what we find. So breeding for yield over 50 years has increased yield, and the rate of improvement is proportional to the environmental expectation. This has been achieved by both the increasing harvest index and biomass. The increase in biomass has been achieved with essentially an increase in radiation use efficiency that's independent of leaf photosynthesis. The increase in radiation use efficiency is related to very complex changes in the nitrogen phenotype of the crop and the architecture of the crop. Essentially, the new varieties absorb more nitrogen. If you look at the canopy at this is from the top, you see more leaves, and the leaves are greener, but in particular at the bottom, there's more radiation at the bottom of the canopy. So essentially, it's a crop where more leaves are contributing to photosynthesis. In this dry environment, we were surprised to find very little or no change in phenotype in relation to water. So yield increase with no change in water use, so water use efficiency has increased at the linear rate for a century or so. An interesting aspect of this, but many other studies, similar studies, is the increase in stomatal conductance. That's a very general response of crop responses to breeding. There's a recent review showing that for tomato, cotton, all the crops what's been looked at, it's a very general response. My idea of what's happening here is that there are three functions of stomata. Regulate gas exchange and water efficiency, prevention of embolism, and canopy cooling. And my bias is that canopy cooling is more important than water efficiency. That's why selection for yield has increased tomato conductance. This is the most recent work, and this proves some early ideas by John Pasure and others of root redundancy. So the idea that we are in a very dry environment, that then we need deeper and more profuse roots, is not supported by the data. There is redundancy. And this has been coupled with an increase in nitrogen uptake per unit root length. So there's been a shift of biomass from roots to shoots. And to understand this, why this is adapting in this environment, we need to look at two other features of the environment, the seasonality and the size distribution of rainfall events. We have a winter rainfall pattern, so the crop in the south and west starts with pretty much an empty soil profile. There's no water at depth. And because rainfall during the season is dominated by small events, the soil never really gets wet at depth. So if there's no water at depth, there's no point in having deep roots. And this is quite striking. So if we think that breeding for yield is a blunt instrument, if we think how the phenotype has been changed, we might probably need to think again. Okay, back to the patterns of stress. So these patterns of drought depend on three things: the soil, the climate, and the sowing to harvest window. So when we grow field pea in the same environment, we expect the same pattern as we have for wheat, and that's what we got. That's quite boring. When we did chickpea, we were surprised because we didn't find stress before flowering. So the first reaction was there's something wrong with the model, but we couldn't fault the model. So we started to look at chickpea and see why it is different. Chickpea is very different to the other crops which evolved within in this Middle Eastern environment. You can see it started much later, and then for 3,000 years, chickpea disappeared. And it appeared again in the Bronze Age. The interpretation of this is Ascochyta. So the individual plants are damaged but survive and produce seed. But when these growers started to grow a nice canopy of chickpea, those crops were just devastated, and they eventually gave up. So there is speculation that these Middle Eastern growers learn from Asian and African growers, and at that point they started to think of growing chickpea in summer to avoid Ascochyta. And we cannot prove that, but there are two lines of evidence that favor that. One is vernalization. Chickpea is the only crop in this group that has lost vernalization requirements. That's from this shift to summer cropping. And the other is the thermal biology of the crop. So we would expect chickpea to be similar to pea or even more adapted to low temperatures, but it's a lot more like soybean. So that's a selective pressure from those early events trying to avoid disease, shifting the crop to summer. But now we're growing the crop back in winter, so it grows slowly compared to pea or wheat. So we grow chickpea in the same environment. The dry spells between rainfall events are the same, but the crop is small, and it's the demand of water that drives the difference between the patterns of water stress. So this is a temperature-related shift in patterns of drought, which I thought is interesting. So we're growing the crops in the same environments, but in one case we need to focus on pre-flowering stress, and in the other case we need to focus on post-flowering stress. So this is a snapshot of all we can learn from environmental characterization for drought, but there's no reason we cannot do the same for other aspects of the environment. We can characterize the thermal regimes for crops in different regions. And this is even easier because we only need the model here to calculate flowering time. So this is chickpea in Australia, and we have three patterns of temperature. A warm pattern, a cool pattern, and one that's the more interesting, starts cool and then shifts into hot or warm. And then we can map and do all the same things that we've done with water. And we can do the same for nitrogen. This is much early days, but growers in Australia ask how much mineralization can we expect so we can adjust nitrogen fertilizer, and we can do the same type of analysis. So to conclude with this section, a note of caution. We are using models to characterize the environment, but then we need to ask how reliable are the models. And this is my star system. We will need something better. But my rule of thumb is if there is more biology, the models are poorer. So the models are better for water than they are for nitrogen, because for nitrogen we have microorganisms that are responding to the environment and so forth. Okay. So GBIE, I would say that the single most important constraint we have to understand GYE is that we lack theoretical frameworks. There are other areas of biology where they are more developed and we can learn from them. Plasticity is central to those theories. If we think of the central question of developmental biology, so our neurons and blood cells are genetically pretty much the same, but they are morphologically and physiologically very different. How is that? No. So we've been working with this perspective of plasticity to understand GYE. A brief comment on methods. Reaction norms, they are the functions relating phenotype and environment, are interesting because they can capture non-linearity. But for, say, yield in a field crop, it's very hard to have a tight function. Say, in Australia, for yield and rainfall, R-square might be 30%. So we have very scattered functions. And there are other approaches, like this variance ratio, that we are favoring. The downside is we have a single value, but we make no assumptions about the relationships. And this is an example of how we're using this concept of plasticity to analyze GYE. We have four cases of different crops. In each case, there are a number of varieties or lines or hybrids in a range of environments, and we selected or we sorted the top 10% as an indication of potential and the bottom 10% yield as an indication of stressful condition and plot that as a function of plasticity of yield. So this is clearly the winner. This is the variety that gives the highest potential but also stress adaptation. And that's contrary to the idea that we need stability. We don't need stability here. The best variety is the less stable one. And Sarah Grogan has shown the same pattern for winter wheat in the Great Plains. This is a small variation of the same thing. The best hybrid is the one with the less stable one, the high plastic hybrid, high potential and no compromise for stress conditions. This is a case where we need to select for stability because that would return stress adaptation and high potential. And this is a more interesting one where there's a trade-off. Do we go for the variety that has the highest yield potential, but the penalty and the drought? And to answer that kind of question, we need to go back to the patterns of stress. What's the probability of having each of those environments? And what are the consequences for the cash flow of the farm, depending on which one selects? Okay. So to conclude, if we're okay with time, we've been doing some phenotyping and genotyping of chickpeas in adaptation to stress. Water stress is managed with irrigation and shelters, but to manage heat stress in the field, we're using sowing date, which is practical, but there are a number of confounded effects. One is what I would call non-stressful effect of temperature. If temperature goes from 24 to 26, yield will be reduced. I wouldn't say that's stressful, but that's essentially shortening pre-phenological stages. And then we have the disruption of reproduction, 35 or something at the wrong time. So with this model, we try to separate both. We've been screening these chickpeas, and we are doing some genetic analysis. But instead of asking the question, what's the genetic control of, say, nitrogen fixation, we ask what's the genetic control of the plasticity of nitrogen fixation. And in this way, we preempt the GYE problem. With the same lines, we've been testing Donald's hypothesis here. The idea is that if there's a large difference between the yield of the crop and the yield of a plant in more relaxed conditions, that genotype would be low-yielding genotype. This is what breeders call the SMILE. So if you have a large difference between the border and the center, that genotype is low-yielding, very likely. So phenotypically, we show that's the case. So there's a negative correlation. The varieties that are high yielding are the varieties that are more responsive to competition. And when we look at the genetic architecture of the yield in the middle row and the border row, they don't match. They are different things. We know that's the case phenotypically. This is an indication that what's driving the yield of the plant in the crop or in the row is different. I will leave it there. Thank you. I'm not aware they're using this concept, but it's a complement to the conventional G/E things. I think we have different insights, but your colleagues here are using that pattern. No, they are high plasticity is low stability.
And do you have any comments about that relationship in
form? I'm sorry, what? No, but there's a talk on corn later, but there's no reason why. I think it's not crop specific, the relationship. I think you could find different relationships depending on the particular combination of genotypes and environment. I don't think what I show for wheat or for pea or rye, I don't think it's particular for the crop. I think it's more the combination of genotypes and environment. There was a toll, yeah.
Did you see additional change in the dwarfs as well?
Yeah. So we have three toll varieties, 58 to 60 something, and then we have from the 60s to 2007 dwarf varieties, same height.
So it continued.
It is continued. So it's both root biomass, root length density drop, and root nitrogen uptake per unit root increase linearly.
Yeah.